That's right. All right. Welcome back, everybody, to the show with no name. Back with the squad. They're back from NYC. Got Bob here as usual. And Charlie and Donnie. You just unlocked the bomb. But real quick, Charlie and Donnie, you guys are back. We had someone film for you last time, but quick vibe check. How was NFT NYC?
Yeah, NFT NYC was basically a great confirmation that the Bitcoin takeover of like all other events that aren't exclusively Bitcoin is real. Like the ETH Denver phenomenon continues at NFT NYC. I didn't even go to the NFT conference. I just went to the side events. And it was also really validating because there's a lot of really smart, good people in New York. And we were able to kind of gather at natural shelling points like PubKey or some restaurant. So, the Ordinals phenomenon is not just a one-time off ETH Denver event.
Nope. And I'll echo that and say that it was like packing a month worth of stuff into 3 or 4 days. I don't think I've ever been that busy or that pulled in so many directions. Not only did we sponsor a bunch of things, but like there were so many other valuable spaces to be in, full of people who have things I want to hear when they talk, you know what I mean? And every time I go to any conference, I go to the conference because everybody else is like, why would I go to the conference? There's not an Ordinals booth. And I'm like, I should go to the conference because there's not an Ordinals booth. I want to know what's going on in the outside world. And I thought this back when I was like into Solana and I wanted to see what Ethereum was doing. And I think it's really good to get a diverse perspective. So I never listen to anyone when they say, don't go to the conference. This is the one time I should have. It was $620 for a ticket. And there literally isn't a conference. There were like six booths. There was one tapestry in the middle of the room. It looked like they just were breaking down for the last hour of the last day, the whole time. It was truly offensive. I was livid. I walked in and I was like, why is this the most expensive conference? And it's like they sent one of the interns to help a few people set something up. It was like truly offensive. So everybody out there, when people tell you not to go to the conference, don't usually listen to them. This one, pretend it's not there. It's a temporal meeting space. That's all it is. The venue is like, it was truly offensive.
NFT NYC is a good forward-looking indicator for the trajectory of NFTs on other blockchains, and the Ordinals space is a good forward-looking indicator. The in-person events is a good forward-looking indicator of the energy that's on the mother chain. It is wild the disparity between these two movements right now.
I love it. We're coming out guns blazing. Pew pew. ETH was the test net.
Okay. I'm just making fun of the organization of the conference. I wasn't saying anything about it.
I saw photos and I'm like, I can't tell if this is just the one shot where he showed up at 6 a.m. or if this is like at 4, but yeah.
It was miserable. It was really miserable.
Crazy. Yeah. Crazy. And then we got a guest on the show today, Mr. Matt Luongo. How you doing, sir?
Doing all right. Very loud AC behind me that will definitely fix in post-production. Doing okay. Thanks for having me, y'all.
Glad to have you. Got a couple of topics. This is going to be kind of almost like a philosophical episode. We're going to go deep into kind of game theory type of stuff. And I think the first prompt is something that you said, Matt, at ETH Denver on stage. There was like an L2 panel. Got heated at times. You mentioned some things about like fee burning and it got a little testy. But one thing that you kind of, sounds like you brought up, but you can make sure I get the framing right, is that there's this question about what's better for the long-term security of Bitcoin. Is it making sure the miners get paid maximally? And this is things like L2s passing fees down to miners and this incentive alignment, if you will. And then there's another side of optimizing for holders, which is where things like fee burning can actually be net benefit for holders. And which one benefits the long-term security model of Bitcoin? So if that's right, I'd love to jump into this kind of topic and give us some other color about this framing.
Yeah. I have some strong positions, but they're loosely held, right? I can be convinced. But it has been about a decade that I've built this position, so maybe it'll take more than just this call. So my thoughts this, right? Before the block size debate finally resolved, we treated miners like they ran the network. And that was wrong, right? We had like a really nice object lesson that miners don't run the network. Users run the network. And the economic majority ultimately decides what is Bitcoin. And for, you know, not for you guys, but for other people listening to this, you know, what happened was the miners got pushy and they aligned with a bunch of application developers and corporations. This led to this New York agreement and this like SegWit2x idea that ended up being a failure. And the thought was it was a compromise between, okay, we're going to activate SegWit, but we're also going to have a 2 megabyte base block size increase. So a doubling before SegWit. And, you know, SegWit2x for me, I was a big blocker. And but it for me was this clarifying moment where I was just like, this is messed up. Like, there should not actually be people in a shadowy room in New York talking and making these decisions. This is ridiculous. And the precedent that it sets can't. Like, I'm an application dev, and so I wanted, give me more network, give me more space. But after this, I became a small blocker, basically. It took me a little bit of, like, licking my wounds, but I just realized, like, that's messed up, and we cannot possibly, this isn't the system I signed up for. And the thing that helped SegWit2x, that made sure it failed, ultimately, was something led partially, this movement led partially by Luke Dash Jr., which is this idea of user-activated soft fork. And so what UASF basically said, and I'm just like broad strokes, is, yeah, if you guys do this, we're all going to go. And we don't really care what the miners say. We can go nuclear. We can change proof of work. We can do all sorts of stuff. And it was this threat, and we didn't see it play out, thankfully. It would have been a mess. But it was this threat that really held, I think it's what tipped everyone to not support 2x. Also, there's a bunch of other issues where the code base was garbage, and I'm glad we didn't activate it because it would have broken Bitcoin. Yeah, yeah.
Like
there's a lot of other.
They nuked their first block.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it was a mess. But like the learning for me was, you know, you think one group has power, but eventually, like, Bitcoin is FU money. And this was a beautiful demonstration of like, you know, and so one of my takeaways from this is we saw a bunch of people basically exit Bitcoin. And some of them did it for good economic reasons, and some of them did it like spoiled children. And we saw a little bit of both, right? We saw miners who got less involved in governance because they kind of got their hands slapped. We saw some exchanges, I won't name any names, who pivoted pretty hard away from Bitcoin and never really came back. And so it was a huge lesson for me in like, what is the role of a miner? So if we believe that proof of work is what I think we all believe it is, which is a permissionless way to basically progress the chain, but that the rules of the network are enforced by nodes, and the nodes that matter are the nodes that have economy behind them. They're the nodes that have personal value and a use case behind them. Then ultimately, what matters is what the economic majority wants. And miners are about progressing the chain and making sure that if they're censored, someone else can step in their place. So for me, that's the beauty of proof of work that we don't get from other mechanisms. So if we think all of that's true, well, the miners work for us. They don't control what happens on the network. And so that brings us to L2s, right? Anything with an L2, any talk of an L2, and even a meta protocol, what we're talking about is we're changing what people get paid to do in Bitcoin. And that's kind of a dangerous thing. So in the same way that it's dangerous to add an opcode that could lead to a bug we didn't have before, instability, it's dangerous to pay people differently. So for me, I'm like, okay, when I look at merge mining and basically anything that is since Bitcoin consensus, I'm like, great. So now we have a party that's completely maybe unaligned with the network that's bribing miners to do things that maybe aren't good for the network. And so that's my concern. And if you look at something like Ethereum, who's going to decide if there's a major contentious fork? So we know what happened in the past. It was like developers. But today, you know, USDT and USDC have a lot of say over what fork is real. And I don't want to see that happen to Bitcoin. And so that's why I'm interested in, okay, how do we reward the economic majority rather than Robbie Miners. Sorry, it's long-winded, but there you go.
I think I generally agree. I say, like, economic participants, a majority. I say, like, Bitcoin security and consensus derives... it, we've seen it derive historically from, like, node participants and economic participants. I still kind of wax a little bit, like, mystical about it, because I like to say that we've seen how it has worked, but we don't know for sure how it will work. I would hope that security would derive from the people actually using Bitcoin. I even go so far as to broaden the definition of people using Bitcoin to people holding and stacking Bitcoin. I'm actually myself, I'll probably take a little bit of a flip on Matt's perspective, and I actually think miners will participate more in the future than they historically have. I think probably the next soft fork may not be miner driven, but it will have a much larger role from miners play in it, just due to the fact that I think it's going to require a lot more hash rate buy-in than before. So previously, like the block size war, you had all the hash rate concentrated in the hands of Jian Wu.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not quite the same anymore, but I think we do have a little bit more different landscape. So
yeah. So Matt, what's your thought on the long tail issuance? You know, do we change the block subsidy? Do we add something like an EIP 1559 to Bitcoin? I'm curious on
I love how you're just laying these mines out for me to just step right onto. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Were I able to make changes to Bitcoin that were not controversial? Yeah, maybe there would be a tail issuance, but I'm not, and that's the beauty of Bitcoin. It's like, I can't do that, and I think that it's completely untenable. Like, I don't see any change to fee mechanisms outside of extensions on other layers. So I'm looking at this two ways. If you're a Bitcoin L2, they'll say there are three or four, but I look at it two ways. If you're a Bitcoin L2 and you're like, okay, how do I, first of all, I'm going to skip over the definition of L2. Because I think that all of that is BS. So what I'm saying is, if you're an economic layer, which is my preference, then what you need to do is, like,
economic layer meaning you contribute fees directly back to the L1. Is that
that's what matters to me? Is you contribute fees back to the L1, and the question becomes, there's a little bit more in my head, but like the question becomes how? Like, how do you contribute back?
Sure.
And yeah, for me, like we made this term up because we were looking for a way to categorize work we're doing. And it's like, what does economic layer mean? It has to use Bitcoin. Like, it can't be some other asset that you're using for gas and stuff like that. That's not cool. It needs to, and then value needs to accrue to L1, but it also needs to accrue to Bitcoin holders. So in our particular case, for designs we've played with, that means Bitcoin holders staking their Bitcoin or earning more on it. So things similar to routing fees on Lightning. But for me, the important thing with economic layer is like, okay, is this net positive for Bitcoin? Because you can imagine a world where a merged mine chain is not. Yep. And so to avoid that, I see two ways outside of like miner bribes. One is a burn, which pisses everyone off. It's a great thing to say on a panel. And I'm interested in it. And I think the only problem that I have with the burn, I mean, for one, anyone who is involved with Counterparty knows, like, you're probably going to regret burning Bitcoin later. So I think that's one issue, is just like, no one wants to be a historical laughing stock. But I think the other issue is like, the amount that you can actually impact Bitcoin's issuance through a burn, it takes you have to be very big for that to actually be much of an impact. So the other idea that I like here is, if we're concerned about long-term consensus stability, why don't you just lock Bitcoin up? Anyone can spend for like 20 years. Make it 30, make it 40. And it starts to become, it's effectively the same as burn for a short-term market cycle. You're taking things out of circulation. Miners can't really complain anymore. Because right now their complaint is, no, we're very aligned with the Bitcoin network. And you're like, you're very aligned with the ASICs you own. right? Which is almost the same, but it's not the same. And if you really want to be aligned, show us that you're not a big net seller of Bitcoin, which is obviously impossible as a miner today. So I think another way to say it is like, no, we're going to give you the bribe. You're going to have to stay in business for a long time to get it.
Interesting. Can I ask a question?
Of course.
This might sound stupid. If Bitcoin is a network where miners are financially incentivized to do the thing that people are paying them to do, and eventually the subsidy, you know, the Coinbase runs out and it runs on transaction fees because, like, it's all too expensive at that point. It doesn't really matter. What are we worried about breaking? Or I guess what territory are we worried about stepping over if we just let it go the way it's going? Like, why do we even have to have these conversations?
I mean, I'm interested in you guys' takes. I'm not an alarmist necessarily about the security budget. I think that we have been doing various forms of cope on the budget almost since day one. And Nick Carter has some killer writing on this, but most of that cope does rely on price appreciation. And I think the reason, I'm going to be frank, I'm not an NFT enjoyer. What I loved about Ordinals is fee market. Like, that for me was like, hell yeah, we finally saw some move. So I think the question is just like, if you look at Ordinals, for example, fees, it's very spiky. And what you don't want is, you don't want a fee market to be spiky and then to have just like incredibly slow blocks and like difficulty using the network and retargeting, expanding. But yeah, you guys might have more of a take here than I do.
I'm the same way as you, Matt. I feel that it's been largely not terribly concerning, although I was actually mostly concerned that we had not been empirically demonstrating a use for Bitcoin's block space and a general rejection of, like, a cultural rejection of, like, let's do anything but the Lightning Network. So, to me, that's why I even really got most interested in Ordinals in the first place, because it opened up this Pandora's box. And the first thing that flew out are JPEGs, but many other things will come out of this box, both scary and amazing. And that is what makes me very excited. So to be long Ordinals type ideas is like one of the most optimistic things for, you know, fending off the tail issuance, voices in the room.
Like, the question I always, sorry, I'm like the youngest Bitcoiner in here. Not like I'm age-wise. I'm probably one of the oldest people all the time everywhere I go. But like, I've been paying attention to Bitcoin the shortest amount of time. So my viewpoints are not really, maybe they're not colored by old school Bitcoin thought, but they're also really not as informed as old school Bitcoin thought. So the tail issuance argument always seemed kind of strange to me, because by the time we get to the point in 120 years or however long that is, that is occurring, the block reward is already minuscule to the point where transaction fees have long since hopefully taken over for that. So even considering that conversation at this point in time just seems so absurd. But I guess if every time the block reward goes down by half, everybody goes, is it going to be enough? And it's always been enough. Why do we think it's not going to be enough if we're using the network more, right? That's where my brain
is. It's going to be a concern. Like, this is, it's just Bitcoin has to demonstrate that it's not a concern. So it's,
which it always does.
Yeah, it always has.
So far.
Yeah, and so far.
You know, I like to think of it as like, is the halving priced in? Of course it's not priced in.
Is it?
By most of the world, of course not. No. But a different way to think of it is like, we talk about how Bitcoin's monetary policy is sacrosanct and doesn't change. It changes every 4 years. And so I would think of it like that, where it's like, it is different that now there's a halving with an ETF. If you look at where money's flowing, that is a very different thing than it was. And so I don't think that, like, you know, there's, you know, next halving or two halvings or whatever, everything stops working. But I do think that we have to be, we have to help make sure there's a fee market. Like, we can't just be like, oh, no, don't build on Bitcoin. These things will just solve themselves. It's math. Like, I think that's pretty, you know, kind of mid. And I think that it doesn't mean we need to change the issuance schedule. But it does mean that, like, well, we need more ordinals like things. We need things that keep block space rivalrous.
For sure. Thank you.
Jumping back just a bit to the economic layer idea, I really like this idea. What did you say were, like, there's a spectrum, essentially, for any given layer on the, economic value that they provide to Bitcoin L1 directly. You mentioned directly contributing to miner fees. You know, if you're, like, as a roll-up, if you're storing data on Bitcoin L1, I mean, that's obviously a win. If you are maybe, like, facilitating layer one transactions in some fashion. And then you mentioned, like, 30, 40-year staking.
I went everywhere. Let me get really tighter. So for, like, the economic layer, what I'm trying to say is, like, if you wanted to qualify for this, and, like, look, I don't have, like, a Bitcoin layers thing I'm launching or anything, so I'm not Bitcoin magazine.
Yeah.
I don't get to announce my editorial policy to everyone, like, who's like, yeah, sure. But, like, if I were, what I would say is, like, I want to see economic alignment out of these projects. Yep. So what that to me means is you were using Bitcoin as your base asset. You are contributing to Bitcoin's economic security. So that could be through straight up merge mining. That could be through burning. That could be through, like, a long time locking up Bitcoin for future miners. I think all of those are interesting options. And then the other one for me is, Bitcoin holders need to make money on this thing. Not just, like, in general, because, like, number go up, but specifically, where is value accruing? If some of the value is not accruing to Bitcoin holders, you messed up. Like, if it's accruing to just a bunch of people you airdropped a token to, and that's it, you probably aren't aligned enough.
Yep. I just really like this reframing. I don't think in the L2 space, like, people don't talk about economic layers. They don't talk about economic incentives. It's actually a pretty refreshing take for me, having explored the large majority of layers on Bitcoin. It feels nice to frame it in a new way, and this feels, like, appropriate to me.
Yeah, I mean, another way to look at it is technical alignment. And that's the rut we've been stuck in for the past, like, 6 or 7 years now.
Yep.
And that's not, like, a slight on Lightning at all, because I'm a huge fan of the work that all the teams there have done. It's just, like, that is one of the most difficult ways to solve some of these problems, is this channel-based, basically state layer. And we just need better words than whether or not something is an L2 and whether or not you have unilateral exit, like, both of those things they don't really add a lot to the conversation, you know. Now, are a bunch of ETH holders making money because of your Bitcoin L2? That, I think, is a really interesting discussion to have.
What if, just really quick, what if we take Lightning? What are the economic benefits?
I'll be like a Lightning apologist and, like, not. So I'll try to take both sides of this. And I'm not telling you where I am. I'm just telling you what I've heard. Over the years, what I've heard is Lightning, like, settlement transactions are long-term going to continue to contribute economically to Bitcoin security because people have to settle, yada, yada, yada. And what I just saw was, well, block space was congested and it made Lightning a lot harder to use. And the other thing that we learned about Lightning is that in a high fiat environment, it's probably not acceptable for non-custodial onboarding of new users. Custodial is fine. We've seen it have product market fit, but we haven't seen it. So, like, if we wanted 8 billion people tomorrow, if we, like, had Bitcoin, we could, like, airdrop to all of them. Like, cool, you've got Bitcoin now. Like, that we're, like, Roger Ver before his turning, before the great, you know, we're, like, we're just, like, out there giving money away to people. We can't do that with Lightning. And it's just, it doesn't work. And I'm not saying that these other supposed L2s necessarily can, but it's just a different approach. I don't know if Lightning will long-term be really good for the economic security of Bitcoin, but I do know that if the fee market does really well, Lightning struggles to onboard new users. And so that's kind of unfortunate. And a good person who would come in here and would argue about, like, channel factories and stuff, but I'm not educated enough to be that person's son.
Interesting. Yeah, thank you.
Interesting. I want to double click on this, like, passing fees down from an L2 to an L1, because people use terms like bribing, which I don't fully know what people mean by that, but there's like two pieces. There's passing fees down to the miners, and then there's accruing value to the holders. And there's different, like merge mining passes them down, and then Liquid as a federation just holds them and they stop there. And so I could see, like, if Solana worked perfectly and the bridge was relatively trustless, I could see Solana being a pretty huge value add, even though it breaks the passing fees down model. So that one feels more important than the other, but I'm curious about that. Any of you guys?
I mean, I think if anything, pays its tithe back to Daddy Bitcoin. Cool.
It's funny because...
Right, I mean...
Okay, it's funny just because that brings up, like, the joke that, like, that the ETH folks have, which is Solana is an ETH L2, and which is now inverted, where Solana's saying, well, maybe ETH, maybe some of your L2s will become our L2s, whatever. I'll reiterate what Bob said. I like this different framing of it. Layer two has always been a very failing term, but it's very easy to, you know, to talk about because everybody knows what you mean. But I think the definitions, there are some teams out there even trying to work on strong definitions of L2s. It doesn't really work very well. I like this idea. I don't know. Can Solana pay Bitcoin base layer fees? Possibly. There's probably a way to do it.
There are some complications. If you're bridging to Solana, like, you have to pay SOL as your gas token. That's not great for the Bitcoin economic thesis. How are you actually facilitating any Bitcoin transactions at all other than bridging, which is probably, you know, doesn't really qualify there? So then when are people making Bitcoin transactions? Like, where are the Bitcoiners actually winning? I mean, it's hard to draw that picture in the straight, just bridge to Solana, now interact on Solana, if it's not rolling up of some kind back to the Bitcoin L1 or paying fees or, I don't know, doing more Bitcoin stuff. I think I'm going to have to go back through all of the Bitcoin L2s and then layers and do this economic incentive. Have you done any of this work, Matt?
Of course, I can't. I feel bad because I don't want to, like, I can't speak for all these other teams and things change. Most of it's not live and yada yada yada. But yeah, I mean, a little bit of the work that I've done. So, like, Solana, imagine that some of its emissions, like native emissions, just like bought and burned Bitcoin. Sure. Suddenly, Solana is like a tithe paying, I don't know, economic layer, if not an L2. I mean, yeah, and then you look at some of, and I'm going to stop naming names because it feels too petty, but you look at some of these L2s and it's like, are your fees going to Ethereum? Which has been a common candidate. So like they're saying, well, this is like a Bitcoin L2, but then there, if you dig, it's like, where are the fees actually going? So I think that's like, probably something that I personally want to avoid. But another really interesting take is Babylon. So what Babylon's trying to do right now is get Cosmos chains to use Bitcoin to basically do timestamping and to solve like certain like long range attacks and other issues with their proof of stake. And I actually thought there's no way in hell a chain team would say yes to that, because like, why? You're kind of giving up like part of your sovereignty. Actually, it turns out some of them will, and they only will because it's Bitcoin. If they were doing that for ETH or for SOL or something else, there's no way. But for Bitcoin, they're like, well, it's Bitcoin. It's like it's the one thing that keeps running. And I think that's the most important part about the Bitcoin network, is that it gives us that economic certainty. This thing will keep running. And so I was actually shocked to hear, I won't out the Cosmos chains, but I think they'll out themselves soon, that they actually want Bitcoin supporting their security.
Yeah, cool. Can I ask another dumb question? Probably are actually dumb questions. Got to be someone dumb watching too, right? So when we talk about network, like bribing the miners, isn't that what every transaction is? There's two parts to this. And one is that. And are they all bribes then?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the whole discussion about what is MEV and what is like what's the game design like working as it's intended, right? So like here's like a really clear example. Binance lost, I don't remember the date, but they lost a bunch of Bitcoin. And there was a proposition that maybe they would bribe the miners to reorg. So that's clearly a bribe, right? That is a please go treat this other chain as your tip and mine off that. And we'll pay you so much that the hack didn't happen. We fixed the hack. And so I think a lot of us would say, like, we don't want that behavior. Like, we want that to happen as infrequently as possible, right? So every transaction at some size can be MEV and can be a bribe. And obviously bribe is just like, that's like just like a slur for just like paying miners to do a thing. It's just like, is it paying miners to do the thing we all expect them to do? Or is it paying miners to kind of like work outside the system? And so like take it a step further. Hey, mine on this chain to keep, because this is where my stablecoin will have value. Or mine on this chain because I want to get in this NFT mint. Or mine on, so I think that's where it starts to become kind of dangerous. And I think a lot of people in the Bitcoin space, I just saw this term MEV, like in evil, like instead of MEV, it's like evil MEV. and I mean, we learned, right? Yeah, it's good. It's catchy, even though I can't say it out loud, I guess. But yeah, we've learned from a lot of other chains what MEV can and can't do. But in Bitcoin's case, if people have really start orphaning blocks, it's bad.
And the 1B then is, what is the intent? What should be happening? Is what should be happening just what can happen? Because that's sort of what like Bitcoin's nature is. Bitcoin's nature is to accept the largest bidders doing and not really tell us what's good and bad about it. Is it like even a rational conversation for us to have about what it should be, or should we be helping it be what it becomes, whatever that is?
What do you guys think? What are you on the filterer debate? I have a feeling I know where you land, but.
Just to really quickly quote Donnie here, Bitcoin is not the arbiter of justice. It is the facilitator of reality. That quote will go down.
That's like that fire. That is fire.
Like that's the new maxi line. And I, you know, recapture this term because it's like the new like hardcore Bitcoiners are like more aggressively advocating for Bitcoin's permissionless than the old guard. It's kind of wild. So,
look, to be clear, I'm on the like no filters, fuck off. If I can pay for block space, I will, etc. I'm just looking long term, and I'm like, okay, just imagine a world where like the largest major exchange chooses which of these forks. And now in the world that I would hope they try to do that, and the rest of us are like, absolutely not, and we choose the other chain. So that would be my hope. But when it happens in little ways, that's where it's hard, because there's not a big moment where we can all socially come together and say no.
So this, sorry, go ahead, Charlie.
Oh, Matt, this gets right at the heart of like a lot of the soft fork conversation right now, because a lot of the urgency behind, say, the op check template verify people or the op cat folks is saying, right now, if everyone, to avoid us having to use custodians for Bitcoin, we have to do something different with Bitcoin. And so this, the way you reduce the power these centralized exchanges have in the future is by not ossifying today. Because if we ossify today, Bitcoin goes into the hands of the Coinbases and the BlackRocks of the world.
The flip side is, if we don't ossify, Bitcoin also goes into the hands of the Coinbases. And so I super sympathetic to your point. I just think that both are dangerous, because like, how do we have a system that's changing that's not captured?
As Paul Mahdieb says, there's a narrow path need to see a way.
Exactly.
My argument, again, probably uneducated, against that it would be possible or frugal or even attractive for Binance to decide to, like, not 51% attack, but like, you know, if you have enough money to move the system becomes yours, and thereby the system is valueless. The system becomes Binance.
Exactly.
So like, it always has seemed to me in the back of my head, maybe I'm just like an optimist in terms of like Bitcoin's ability to just shrug off whatever anything might throw at it. But like, if I had enough money to 51% attack Bitcoin, I wouldn't waste that money attacking something that I'm going to devalue by attacking it. So like, it just,
that sounds good because you're a long-term thinker, right?
But it's not always.
CZ actually tried to do this. Like, this was on the table and he was trying to figure it out after this hack. Like, this happened. And it's like, you know, if Bitcoin survives because we're all low ego, Bitcoin's not going to survive. Like, that's not, you know what I mean? So, like, you, Donnie, are clearly, like, a modest person. And I'm, like, listening to you. I'm, like, you're, like, dropping fire quotes. And you're, like, well, this is an educated bud. This is complete fire, right? So, right? So, like, you know, yeah, if we had more Donnies, I agree. But, like, and I don't know CZ, so I'm not even trying to make an attack on his character. It's just, like, we're talking about billions of dollars and that power being really concentrated by these exchanges and now by the ETF. And so I think, yeah, Charlie, I think your point is topical with Dune, but also, like, really good because, like, it's like if Dev becomes so active that you can, like, make a change and it hits the network in the same sort of time frame that Ethereum or something like Zcash changes, it's not going to be good. We really need a slow path. And for me, if I see soft forks start landing and it doesn't take 2 years to get consensus, I might be out. Or at least, I don't know, I got to figure out something to do with my life because that's it gets into, like, the Fed territory. Like, who made this decision? Where were they? Were they in New York? Was there an agreement?
Yeah. One other filters take for you, Matt, is a lot more products are coming out, like Slipstream, where they accept non-standard transactions. Is there a path in the future where standardness rules become eliminated and you just have consensus rules?
I think standardness rules are silly. For me, I think they're silly. As someone who tries to build interesting things on Bitcoin, I'm constantly running up against this. And it's like, you know, if it's important to you, make it part of consensus. And if it's not, don't. So I think that they're like a social flex, and I don't like it.
Yeah. Nice take.
It should be like on the node level, if you're running a Raspberry Pi, yeah, you can check that box so your mempool doesn't crash, but otherwise just go.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, I want to take a hard left turn. We just spent 40 minutes deep diving. This was fantastic. You can't find these conversations anywhere else. Donnie, you got your flowers as the resident philosopher king, so hell yeah. This was midwit to the right curver conversation the past 40 minutes. Now we're going to go the opposite side and go full degen and talk about runes and uncommon goods. And I'll give the preface I can, and then you guys can fill me in. But as far as I know, the first rune to be etched is going to be called Uncommon Goods. It's going to start at the halving when runes goes live and go to the next halving. It has an uncapped supply, and so there's this kind of a game theory of, like, the cost of an uncommon good is the cost of a transaction at some level. That's really all I know. I don't know anything else about this except for, like, you know, hearing a little bit about Casey and Spaces.
You can etch one per block, correct? And it's non-fungible. Wait, below
one per
wait.
Transaction, right?
No, one per transaction. Is that what it is? One per transaction and not fungible.
I thought it was one per block, but I read it about it last night, so I'm not the best person.
The same.
I think you can mint, not etch. Etch is like deploy. Oh yeah, and then minting with runes. Every runes transaction, every runes action, whether it's etching a token or minting a token, is 1-to-1 tied to a Bitcoin transaction. So you can do multiple mints for a rune in the same transaction. You can do as many Bitcoin transactions as you want in the same block. That's okay.
It's one per transaction, and he hasn't etched or deployed the rune yet, but he says that it's going to be hard-coded. Maybe it is hard-coded already. I've actually verified.
It is. It is.
It's a single uncommon good ticker dollar UG, we assume.
Yeah, so it's not divisible. You can essentially mint one uncommon good rune token every Bitcoin transaction. And it is hard-coded already. You can see that there's the block start and there's the block end. It does have a max, but the max is 2 to the 128th, which is the theoretical maximum for all tokens. And it's just in there because it has to be in there, I guess.
Molecules of the universe, something like that. It's like the same number, isn't it?
Yeah. People have estimated total supply just based on how big a runes transaction is. And I think it's around, 20 billion? It's like 2 to 20 billion total supply if all Bitcoin transactions just minted UG token for the next 4 years. So supply is going to be less than that.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you think is going to happen then? Because like the something we talked about with BSK20s is like that race to the finish was very enticing for DGens. You know, once you cross like 50% minted, it's like a race to close it out. Hopefully price goes up. Obviously, as we said in the previous episode, like BSK20s, easy to deploy, easy to mint, hella hard to transfer. Good for number go up. But what do we think is going to happen with like a 4-year supply of just like it's a box and DGen in the beginning, LOL in the middle, DGen at the end? Like what's the play here?
Okay. Out the gate, who knows? It's clearly driven by mania and speculation. I'm most interested in what happens a year into this. Because in such a scenario, it's the dominant rune. I don't see that it ever becomes like not in the pantheon of runes tickers. In such a scenario, what's like how many bytes does it take how many bytes or weight units of block space will that take up? Theoretically, any economically rational Bitcoin participant would mint runes by default with a Bitcoin transaction, every transaction they broadcast, when the fee rate it makes sense based upon the sale price of that rune and the fee rate times bytes they take it up to include that optional op return. So this actually creates a really interesting like side market, fee market to regular Bitcoin transactions, which we could see. I like to like speculate, but like we could see this become a driving force of how wallets even calculate fees, or even how wallets a year or two from now even like make like fee rate estimation logic. This is something which is a very simple, dumb idea, which could really impact the incentives on Bitcoin. It blows my mind.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of has the same problem. I'm figuring out the mechanism, so just y'all tell me if this is dumb. But it kind of reminds me of people who say, Bitcoin is the price of the electricity that generated it.
Yeah.
That's obviously not true, right? That to that person who generated it, there was a floor. We know that they thought it was at least worth it to yada, yada, yada. But it's a price point, but it's not like it doesn't like have long-term staying power necessarily. And so I wonder if that's like, I guess what I'm getting at is if people keep using uncommon goods and there continues to be interest, it would make sense that it would be kind of like an oracle for price.
Yeah.
If they keep using it.
It's like how miners have demand response strategies based upon the variable price of their power versus the price of Bitcoin. We could see basically block space demand response in the terms of uncommon goods being minted. Crazy.
There is here. Sorry, go ahead, Buck. No, I was just going to say, I don't see any like near-term strategy for uncommon goods other than I've seen whispers of people doing like the first 10,000 uncommon goods minted as part of like a 10K collection of sorts. So there is some hype there where people are speculating as people do, like who wouldn't want to own one of the first 10,000 of the very first hard-coded rune token that, you know, assuming in 4 years that we're all still here, you know, doing this show once a week and ordinals are a thing and runes are still a thing. I mean, uncommon goods will be like the ultimate OG runes token, massive supply. If you were here early, you could get it for free, bit almost. So I don't know. There is some like first 10K speculation happening and people will probably go for it, especially because I don't think you can mint a rune before it is etched and you have to etch it in the block. And so, although I guess if you etch it in the block, then you can mint it in that block, because as long as your fee rate is lower than the etching, then I think you can. So yeah, you could etch or mint any kind of token in the first block. So yeah.
So here's my question to bring all this conversation back to one. Who do you think is going to buy the first block and just fill it with uncommon goods? Like, who is going to buy an entire block, fill the entire thing as a marketing stunt, and then hold all of them and assume that that drives it to the moon?
My bet is nobody. Yeah.
It'd be very expensive to do that.
It'd be very expensive. And this is that kamikaze pilot theory we were just talking about earlier. Who has enough money that they want to potentially devalue the entire experience by spending all that money to control the experience? Because then it kind of isn't what it was supposed to be to begin with. Doesn't mean someone won't do it, though. Right.
The flip side, though, is people pull stunts like this at other chains that it costs millions of dollars because the stunt is such good marketing. It's a global consensus mechanism. So everyone using the chain is suddenly impacted, right? And so it's like, I mean, we used to have people pay to share their engagements in OP return. Why not? I mean, yeah, it's expensive. I'm not saying I have the change in my back pocket. We're just saying it's doable.
There is a reasonable likelihood that there is some conglomerate of degens, runes tooling, marketplaces, and mining pools, you know, put all of them together. And now you have people that are all incentivized to get a chunk of runes tokens. Imagine that you can not only get a bunch of uncommon goods, but you can also etch the first 10 tokens, the first 10 runes tokens, the first 100 runes tokens, the first 500 runes tokens, and you could mint a whole bunch within that block, and then you can distribute all of that to the people in your, you know, group. I don't know. It seems like there's likely something here that could happen.
If that group doesn't exist, should we be that group?
Right now. Right after this, we're going to get on a call and we're going to figure it out. The thing that this brought up in my head that sort of goes to a different... Did you hear what Johannes did yesterday or 2 days ago? He's the guy who forked mempool into ordpool.space and allows you to like look at ordinals transactions. He's set up a protocol where if you make the lock time on a transaction 21, which means that the transaction broadcast wouldn't clear until after block 21, which has already happened, so there's no delay on it. When you do this, it automatically generates a cat whose coloration is determined by the fee structure. So like there's now this protocol that is you can basically mint a cat with an unlimited supply. And again, the same dynamics play where there's a first 10,000, there's a first 100,000, there's an unlimited supply potentially. But every time you're doing anything else, you can set the lock time as 21. It won't change anything about the transaction. You can get yourself a cat with the color pertaining to the fee structure.
One caveat, I thought that it's kind of like what Matt was saying earlier of like you can lock it to 40 years in the future with the lock time of the transaction. I think that 21 is it's locked for 21 blocks. So it's locked for a few hours and then you can transfer and spend it.
The way Johannes said it, and this is, again, I don't know. He said that when you put the lock, it's not a lock time, it's a lock block. So anything after the block that is listed there will be sent. So there's never a delay because it's waiting for block 21, which has already happened. That's the way he verbalized it, but maybe there's a language.
Yeah, so it's actually on chain, but it doesn't actually lead to a lockup. Just means your wallet's going to be a pain in the ass. A lot of wallets won't know what to do.
Got it. So the following question: what sort of GUI changes are we going to see in very common ordinals wallets that are going to allow you to like mint runes and make cats and do all these other things according to all these new protocols that are coming out on Bitcoin? When you're at the end of the transaction or about to broadcast it and you're choosing the fee, is there going to be like mint a cat or mint uncommon? So like, is someone just going to be doing this stuff or are they going to do it for you? Like, I don't know. It's exciting to see.
I think yes. Why not? Why not? It does increase block space, but if there are economic incentives to tack on additional things, you know, if you're inscribing an ordinal, why not add a little op return and mine some of the latest degen runes? You know, why not add a 21 to your lockup and get some cats? It feels like, especially with meme coins going crazy, like why not, as you transact, earn memes, the memes of the day? It feels like the perfect opportunity.
Like Candy Crush.
Yeah.
You don't really need a reward. It's just fun. It's the noises make it fun.
Asset heterogeneity on Bitcoin is one of the most fascinating and terrifying things ever. And it's almost, we let the cat out of the bag. We can't put the genie back in the bottle. But I think the discussion should be over how much heterogeneity is okay. Not is heterogeneity even possible, because we've clearly demonstrated that it is inevitable.
It's a bold damn.
Idioms,
so much,
top to bottom.
There's so much flips. so much.
You got to settle down, Charlie. That was a little too fantastic for this group right now.
I was waiting for him to say we're going to do a little magic. I was just waiting for it.
But on the topic of, like, you slap on an operator and get a little bit of extra value in that transaction, that does seem like if you play it out long enough, it does start to hurt fungibility because you have two different assets of sliding value. And so I wonder, like, currently everyone kind of has, like, your Ordinals wallet and it segregates fungible sats with other types. But there's no easy way to, like, uncheck that. That's an advanced feature for users currently. So I assume that the two lenses, Ordinals lens, fungible sats lens, will in the future be like you click it and it's going to not delete, but like it won't recognize your operturn rune and just go back to sats. That seems like how it's going to play out.
Well, the nice thing about runes is you can just consolidate. It's not like permanent bloating. Even within the runes protocol, you can have a whole bunch of runes, UTXOs, that you can just smash together. And so then you don't have like extra sats sitting around. You just have one UTXO that can manage all of your runes. So that's like the main, you know, runes doesn't bloat the UTXO set idea. Where BRC20, like Ordinals, still recognizes BRC20 mint inscriptions for all time and eternity. And so it's just going to sit there. And you actually have to uncheck, like, I don't care about these things. Don't index these things. Let me spend these things for them to be able to be, like, you know, aggregated and sent out.
All right, that was an hour, guys. I think this is a good time to call it. Fantastic episode. So that's the pod.